The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support from Carl and Pat Kappen, and we thank them for their support. And today we continue reading from the October edition of Smithsonian, The Noble Fury of Samuel Adams, and that's the front cover, A Bold New View of the Forgotten Founder, Founding Force by Stacy Schiff. And it says at the top of the page, exclusive book excerpt. And there's a painting of Samuel Adams, John Singleton Copley's 18th century portrait of Samuel Adams, now resides in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. How America's first politician galvanized a colony and helped set a revolution in motion. Samuel Adams delivered what may count as the most remarkable second act in American life. It was all the more confounding after the first. He was a perfect failure until middle age. He found his footing at 41 when, over a dozen years, he proceeded to answer to Thomas Jefferson's description of him as truly the man of the Revolution. With singular lucidity, Adams plucked ideas from the air and pinned them to the page, layering in moral dimensions, whipping up emotions, seizing and shaping the popular imagination. On a rainy night in 1774, when a group of Massachusetts farmers settled in a tavern before the fire and, pipes in hand, discussed what had driven Bostonians mad, reasoning that Parliament might soon begin to tax horses, cows, and sheep, wondering what additional affronts could come their way, and concluding that it was better to rebel sooner rather than later. It was because the long arm of Adams had reached them. He muscled words into deeds, effecting, with various partners, a revolution that culminated in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence. It was a sideways, looping, secretive business. Adams steered New Englanders where he was certain they met or should mean to head, occasionally even revealing the destination along the way. As a grandson acknowledged, shallow men call this cunning, and wise men wisdom. The patron saint of late bloomers, Adams proved a political genius. John Adams swore that his cousin Samuel was born to sever the cord between Great Britain and America. John also believed Samuel an original. Samuel mystified even his peers. Serene, sunny, tender, he seemed instinctively to grasp what righteous anger could accomplish. From four feckless decades, he emerged intensely disciplined, an indomitable master of public opinion. In a colony from which, as a crown officer observed, all the smoke, flame, and lava erupted, Samuel Adams seemed everywhere at once. If there was a subversive committee in Massachusetts, he sat on it. If there was a subversive act, he was somewhere near or behind it. He eats little, drinks little, sleeps little, thinks much, and is most decisive and indefatigable in the pursuit of his objects, a Philadelphia colleague noted unhappily. His enemies insisted, Samuel came in handy. Our friends are either blind to our faults or not faithful enough to tell us of them. He knew that we are governed more by our feelings than by reason. With rigorous logic, he lunged at the emotions. He made a passion of decency. He was a prudent revolutionary. Among the last of his surviving words is a warning to Thomas Paine. Happy is he who is cautious. Deeply idealistic, a moral people, Adams held would elect moral leaders. He believed the virtue of the soul of democracy. To have a villainous ruler imposed on you was a misfortune. To elect him yourself was a disgrace. At the same time, he was unremittingly pragmatic. Adam saw no reason that high-minded ideals should shy from underhanded tactics. Power worried him. No one ever believed he possessed too much of the stuff. His sympathies lay with the man in the street, to whom he believed government answered. A friend reduced Adam's politics to two maxims. Rulers should have little, the people much. And privilege should make way for genius and industry. Railing against the odious hereditary distinction of families, Adams fretted about vanity, frivolity, and political idolatry. He did his best to contain himself when his colleague, John Hancock, who traveled with the pomp and retinue of an Eastern prince, appeared in a gold-rimmed crimson velvet waistcoat and an embroidered white vest. In 1794, Adams was inaugurated as governor of Massachusetts. To maintain ceremonial standards, a benefactor produced a carriage. Adams directed the coachman to drive his wife to the state house, to which he proceeded at 71 on foot. On no count did he mystify more than in his disregard for money. I glory in being what the world calls a poor man. If my mind has ever been tinctured with envy, the rich and the great have not been its objects, he wrote his wife of 16 years, who hardly needed a reminder. As a precarious point, she supported the family, having dissipated a fortune, having run his father's malt business into the ground, having contracted massive debts. Adams lived on air, or on what closer inspection revealed to be the charity of friends. A rarity in an industrious, hard-driving, aspirational town, he was the only member of his Harvard class to whom no profession could be ascribed. Certainly, no one turned up at the Second Continental Congress as ill-dressed as Adams, who for some weeks wore the suit in which he dove into the woods near Lexington hours before the battle. It was shabby to begin with. Alone among our founders, his is a riches-to-rags story. There was an elemental purity about the man whom crown officers believed the greatest incendiary in the king's dominion. Puritan simplicity never lost its appeal. Afflictions invigorated. Adams handily beat Ben Franklin at Franklin's 13-point project for arriving at moral perfection. On meeting Adams in the 1780s, a foreigner marveled. It was unusual in life, or on the stage, for anyone to conform so neatly to the role he played. Here is what a Republican looked like. In July 1774, newly arrived in London and reeling still from seasickness, Thomas Hutchinson, the royal governor of Massachusetts, was whisked off for a private interview with George III. For 2 hours, Hutchinson briefed his sovereign on American affairs. The king seemed as eager to show off his knowledge as to learn what was happening in the most unruly of his American colonies. He asked about Indian extinction and the composition of New England bread. He had heard of Adams, but had not grasped that he was the cause of so many royal headaches. Hutchinson revealed that Adams was a great man of the party. Who gave him his influence? Inquired the king. A great pretended zeal for liberty and a most inflexible natural temper, Hutchinson explained, adding that Adams had been the first to advocate for American independence. He was a prudent revolutionary, Among the last of his surviving words is a warning to Thomas Paine. Happy is he who is cautious. Deeply idealistic, a moral people, Adams held, would elect moral leaders. He believed virtue, the soul of democracy. To have a villainous ruler imposed on you was a misfortune. To elect him yourself was a disgrace. At the same time, he was unremittingly pragmatic. Adams saw no reason that high-minded ideals should shy from underhanded tactics. Power worried him. No one ever believed he possessed too much of the stuff. His sympathies lay with the man in the street, to whom he believed government answered. A friend reduced Adams' politics to two maxims. Rulers should have little, the people much, and privilege should make way for genius and industry, railing against the odious hereditary distinction of families. Adams fretted about vanity, frivolity, and political idolatry. He did his best to contain himself when his colleague John Hancock, who traveled with the pomp and retinue of an Eastern prince, appeared in a gold-trimmed crimson velvet waistcoat and an embroidered white vest. In 1794, Adams was inaugurated as governor of Massachusetts. To maintain ceremonial standards, a benefactor produced a carriage. Adams directed the coachman to drive his wife to the State House, to which he proceeded at 71 on foot. On no count did he mystify more than in his disregard for money. I glory in being what the world calls a poor man. If my mind has ever been tinctured with envy, the rich and the great have not been its objects. He wrote his wife of 16 years, who hardly needed a reminder. At a precarious point, she supported the family. Having dissipated a fortune, having run his father's malt business into the ground, having contracted massive debts, Adams lived on air, or on what closer inspection revealed to be the charity of friends. A rarity in an industrious, hard-driving, aspirational town, he was the only member of his Harvard class to whom no profession could be ascribed. Certainly no one turned up at the Second Continental Congress as ill-dressed as Adams, who for some weeks wore the suit in which he dove into the woods near Lexington, hours before the battle. It was shabby to begin with. Alone among our founders, his is a riches-to-rags story. There was an elemental purity about the man whom crown officers believed the greatest incendiary in the king's dominion. Puritan simplicity never lost its appeal. Afflictions invigorated. Adams handily beat Ben Franklin at Franklin's 13-point project for arriving at moral perfection. On meeting Adams in the 1780s, a foreigner marveled. It was unusual in life or on the stage for anyone to conform so neatly to the role he played. Here was what a Republican looked like. In July 1774, newly arrived in London and reeling still from sickness, Thomas Hutchinson, the royal governor of Massachusetts, was whisked off for a private interview with George III. For 2 hours, Hutchinson briefed his sovereign on American affairs. The king seemed as eager to show off his knowledge as to learn what was happening in the most unruly of his American colonies. He asked about Indian extinction and the composition of New England bread. He had heard of Adams, but had not grasped that he was the cause of so many royal headaches. Hutchinson revealed that Adams was a great man of the party. What gave him his influence, inquired the king, a great pretended zeal for liberty and a most inflexible natural temper, Hutchinson explained, adding that Adams had been the first to advocate for American independence. Making the same point differently, Jefferson called Adams the earliest, most active, and persevering man of the Revolution. For many years, it was possible to assert that he ranked with, if not above, George Washington. His fame spread alongside New England obstreperousness, which he hoped to make contagious. "Very few have fortitude enough," Adams wrote, neatly summarizing his life's work, "to tell a tyrant they are determined to be free." Various patriots made their mark as the Samuel Adams of North Carolina, the Samuel Adams of Rhode Island, or the Samuel Adams of Georgia. The character of your Mr. Samuel Adams runs very high here. I find many who consider him the first politician in the world, a Bostonian reported from 1774 London. John Adams was met with a hero's welcome when he arrived in France 4 years later to help solicit an alliance. He hurried to clarify. He was not the renowned Mr. Adams. That was another gentleman. No one believed him. "Without the character of Samuel Adams," declared John, "the true history of the American Revolution can never be written." And yet it was, for various reasons. Samuel Adams engaged in a delicate, dangerous business. He was, in the eyes of the British administration, for years a near outlaw, ultimately an actual outlaw. Had events turned out differently, he would have been the first to the gallows. Much of his work depended on plausible deniability. He covered tracks and erased fingerprints. He made no copies of his letters. John Adams watched helplessly in 1770s Philadelphia as his cousin fed whole handfuls of papers to the fire in the room. "Was he perhaps overreacting?" asked John. "Whatever becomes of me," Samuel explained, "my friend shall never suffer by my negligence." In the summer, he used scissors to cut bundles of letters to shreds and scattered the confetti from the window, sparing his associates, if stopping the biographer's heart. Portion of what he did not manage to destroy, met with some mistreatment, of which we have only hints. He operated by stealth, melting into committees and crowd actions, pseudonyms, and smoky back rooms. "There ought to be a memorial to Samuel Adams in the CIA," quips a modern historian, dubbing him America's first covert agent. We are left to read him in the twisted arm, the borrowed set of talking points, the indignation of America's enemies. We know more about him from his apoplectic adversaries than from his friends, sworn to secrecy. Unlike his contemporaries, Adams did not preen for the posterity. He wrote no memoir, resisting even calls to assemble his political writings. He left the history to others with predictable results. The more so as his ideas diverged from those of post-revolutionary America, where he wound up intellectually homeless. Sometimes history blossoms after the fact, and sometimes it evaporates. Adams escaped the golden haze that settled around his fellow founders, as if it were too extravagant for him. He hailed from the messy, anarchic, provocative years. It would not help that he would be confused with John, who collected his own letters, wrote prolifically for the Record, and since adolescence had rehearsed for greatness. Adams was rare for his ability to keep a secret, any number of which he took to the grave, including the backstory of the Boston Tea Party, which he knew as well as anyone. Dryly, he noted that some individuals enjoyed every political gift except that of discretion. He freely discussed his limitations, reminding friends that he understood nothing of military matters, commerce, or ceremony, though Congress charged him at various times with all three. Most of America's founders became giants after independence. Adams began to shrink. A cloud of notoriety survives him. The fame does not. He would be minimalized in any number of ways. He is the sole signer of the Declaration of Independence to come down to us as incendiary and a beer. Throughout the 1760s, Adams warned of and watched for imperial overreach. The Americans should resist all blandishments. Their rights stood in danger. That was before the royal governor of Massachusetts requested troops to maintain order in restive Boston. Crown officials had been terrorized. The home of Thomas Hutchinson, then lieutenant governor, had been sacked. The newspapers bristled with sedition. To much consternation, two regiments materialized in the harbor late in 1768. In a massive military parade, bayonets fixed, flags flying, fifes and drums playing, redcoats marched into central Boston on October 1. A train of artillery followed behind. At least for the next weeks, the town went uncharacteristically quiet. Crown officials reported that they had not slept so well in years. At the same time, occupation moved Adams to the moral high ground. Was it not an insult for a free people to be surrounded by men of war, the streets invaded by soldiers? Two additional regiments soon washed up in Boston, which added up to a red coat for nearly every adult man. Tensions mounted weekly, exacerbated by Adams and his friends who advertised the troops' antics, real and fictional. Adams pronounced himself pleased that by the following winter even women and children had begun to ridicule the occupiers, plundering the New England vocabulary for every insult, blasting redcoats with all the abusive language they could invent. The soldiers were bloody back-thieving dogs, or damned SOBs. They were stalked, threatened, hissed at, knocked down, pelted with stones, mud, spittle, snowballs, and pieces of brick, dismissed by the magistrates, to whom they took their complaints. Boston made trophies of their swords and epaulets. The town was a tinderbox well before the first week of March 1770, when, ill humor pulling all around, a brawl erupted on the steps of Adams' front door. Around a steaming tar kettle, ropewalk workers exchanged blows with grenadiers from the 29th Regiment. The soldiers battled with cutlasses and clubs, the workers with long sticks used to twist lengths of hemp. They went four rounds, though considerably outnumbered, the ropewalkers drove off the soldiers. Scuffles continued throughout the weekend as cutlasses flashed and insults flew. By Sunday, a cudgel had two. One British soldier wound up with a fractured arm and skull. Mutters of revenge circulated. In a shop of grenadiers, wife crowed that before Tuesday, the soldiers would wet their swords in New England blood. The maid who spent her Sunday near the rope walk heard there would be a fight the following evening. Ringing bells would signal a brawl rather than a fire, information she did not share with Hutchinson, her employer and the acting governor. His counsel did, warning that it was apprehended by the smaller phrase that would be followed by one more general. Later in the year, Adams would claim that soldiers, gloating that blood would soon run through the streets, promised that many who would dine on Monday would not breakfast on Tuesday. Early in the evening of March 5, 1770, under a slim moon, parties of soldiers could be seen prowling about. According to Adams, they carried a variety of weapons. The town's winding lanes crackled with tension, as amid drifts of fresh snow, Boston came alive. Blows were exchanged in several neighborhoods. A crowd collected in central Boston on King Street near the Customs House. They hurled snowballs, oyster shells, and chunks of ice at a sentry, taunting him and creating a commotion. Earlier, he had tangled with a few boys, whom he attempted to strike with the end of his gun. Whistling and shrieking, the boys returned with friends. The sentry cried out for assistance. Thomas Preston, the regimental captain, rushed to his side, accompanied by 7 men. They and their bayonets electrified the crowd. Preston ordered his soldiers to level their guns. The townspeople surged toward the jagged semicircle, pressing closely upon the redcoats, nearly impaling themselves. A hat would not fit between the soldiers and the civilians, too close to hurl anything but words, as they did from every direction. Their house to the brick customs house wall, the soldiers found themselves surrounded on 3 sides by jeering Bostonians, pushing and shoving, the ground slippery underfoot. "Damn you, fire and be damned. We know you dare not," they shouted, whistling at the cowardly rascals and attempting to knock muskets free. Overhead, the bells began to toll. Moonlight glinted on the weapons. A concerned citizen maneuvered his way through the crowd. A hand on Preston's crimson-coated shoulder, he asked if the soldiers' guns were loaded. They were. Did the captain intend to fire upon the inhabitants? "By no means," Preston replied, as he must truly have believed. He stood directly in front of his men. No sooner had he spoken than a stick slashed through the air, sending a grenadier sprawling across the ice. A shot rang out. Seconds or minutes later came another crackle of musket fire. Cries of "To arms! To arms!" filled the air. The town drums beat for a militia. Bells rang frantically. Many scrambled home for guns. Some cowered behind frosted windows. Others rushed to King Street. The crowd swelled to more than 1,000. Before the situation deteriorated further, someone had the good sense to sprint the half-mile to Hutchinson's house to alert the acting governor. The town was in an uproar. The sight of dead bodies and crimson snow had made it wild. There would soon be carnage everywhere. On Boston's south side, the bells interrupted a meeting of a small social club. Its members snatched hats and coats and ran out to assist. They, too, evidently assumed in quenching a fire. Bells rang in the night for only one reason. John Adams was among the club members who joined the throng, streaming toward King Street. His cousin may have been as well. Well, there's our cue that we're out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening.